true patriot is one who protects his country from his government. And Charlie Bell is a true patriot. Charlie says, answer our petition now. On the table here is the petition for redress of grievances. There are some 78 exhibits. Our petition for redress of grievances regarding the government's violation of the taxing clauses, the war powers clauses, the money clauses, and the privacy clauses are contained on this table in these documents. It all started back in 1999, right here at the press club, in this very room. People from 16 states gathered after the government refused to attend two academic symposiums that we had scheduled to try and get the government to address some of the issues at that time involving the direct unapportioned income tax. Government failed twice. And in this room, we put the finishing touches to a remonstrance, a petition for redress of grievances, which we called a remonstrance. A remonstrance is a word that was used more often in the early days of our country than it is used today, but nonetheless it means a strongly worded statement of grievances that the people submit to their government. This is such a remonstrance, signed by 8,900 people. And on April 13th of 2000, three of us were granted an audience in the White House to present this petition for redress of grievances. Joe Bannister, myself, and Burr Dietz, with Burr recording the event on video tape. Jason Furman, President Clinton's economic advisor, accepted on tape our petition for redress of grievances. We explained to him on tape how difficult it has been to get the government, together with people like Phil Hart and others who are raising these questions, and that we'd like to try again, we said at that time, here at the press club, in this room, on June 29th of 2000, Mr. Furman, Jason Furman, Executive Director of the National Council of Economic Advisors, a key White House department, speaking for the President, said we'll be there. We will have the White House lawyers and historians review the research reports and the evidence that we were submitting along with the written remonstrance, and we'll be there to answer your questions. We had people here representing every state in support of the service of that petition on the president. After the White House, the entire delegation then walked up the National Mall to the Capitol, where the three of us, it had been arranged for the three of us to go in and meet with Speaker Hastert's policy director, a man named Dr. William Ketzel. And on tape, he accepted this remonstrance, this petition, for Speaker Hastert. And on tape, he promised to participate in the June 29th conference. We were delighted. He said he'll have the experts at the House Ways and Means Committee review our questions, and answers will be provided. We were thrilled. Joe Bannister and I and Burr Dietz walked through the rotunda to the Senate side of the Capitol, where we met with Trent Lott's policy director, Keith Hennessy. On tape, he accepted for the Senate Majority Leader our petition. and promised to participate in the June 29th conference to answer some of the questions and address the issues. We were thrilled. The word went across the country, finally the government is going to answer many of these questions. And we started to prepare for the June 29th, 2000 conference. But on June 2nd, and I called the White House and spoke to Jason Perman, and he told me, "Mr. Schultz, we've changed our minds. The legality," he said, this is a direct quote, "the legality of the income tax is not a high priority matter for the White House." And I said, "You mean to tell me it's okay that you may not have any authority to do what you're doing, to force companies to withhold this pay from the paychecks of their employees and to force most working men and women of America to file these tax returns and to pay this tax? You may not have any authority. You may be, what you're doing may be repugnant to the taxing clause of the Constitution, and yet the IRS is out there doing what it's doing to people, and you don't think that that's a high priority matter for the White House. The President doesn't think so. Sorry, Mr. Schultz, we'll not be participating in your June 29th conference." And we got the same then response, change of heart, from the Speaker's office and the Senate Majority Leader's office. Well, as most folks know, if you've been following, everything we've done is factual. We only deal with facts. We don't deal with opinions. But we record everything on our website. We went ahead with the June 29th conference here. A week after that conference, we ran our first full-page ad in USA Today, an educational ad. Not telling people what to do, but just conveying to them the facts as we had checked them out and determined them to be accurate. That was the first of four such ads we ran. Along the way, we had a truth in taxation hearing. I mentioned a while ago that I, as part of this process, I felt I had no other choice but to go on a hunger fast. At the time, that was the appropriate next step. And it did elicit a response from the White House. I did receive, in the 18th day of the fast, a letter from Lawrence Lindsay. He wrote it and sent it over, and what he said was, "You will receive. We the People Foundation and those asking the questions will receive a responsive response from the IRS and the Department of Justice." And the date was set for September 25th and 26th at a secure location on Capitol Hill to be presided over by Congressman Bartlett. The IRS and the DOJ, both Commissioner Rosati at the time and Attorney General Ashcroft, had agreed to participate in the two-day conference. But after 9/11, we asked to have that conference moved, that hearing moved. And the new date was set for February 27th and 28th, the year 2002. But in January, the government pulled out, said they would not be participating. We went ahead with that two-day conference, that two-day hearing. We rented the ballroom at the Marriott, and we put under oath over a two-day period constitutional attorney, tax attorneys, CPAs, former IRS agents, principal tax law researchers, and they answered the questions that the government would not answer. We recorded it. We obtained a transcript, a certified transcript of the two-day hearing. And on April 15th, 2002, many people gathered here in Washington, and we personally served a copy of the record of that hearing on every congressman, all 535 congressmen, as well as the president. And we asked them to act accordingly. Out of 535 congressmen and the president, we received about 60 responses to our petition, supported by all of the evidence that came out of the two-day hearing. Not one of those 60 responses was responsive to our petition. My congressman, as an example, John Sweeney, who I happen to know, I was one of those serving the record of that hearing on April 15th of 2002. And I served him. Someone in his office accepted the petition that day with all the evidence. And on April 16th, his office sent me a response. The response said, "Dear Bob," this is from my congressman, "Dear Bob, I agree the level of taxation is overburdensome. And I've supported the president's, this bill and this other one that's on the floor of the House and this other one and so forth, all designed to reduce, provide tax credits and reduce the level of taxation." That response was non-responsive, obviously, to what we had communicated, what I had communicated to him the day before. Senator Thompson from Tennessee wrote to his constituent and said, glad you stopped into the office when you were in Washington. Do you know we have a website now? It is so-and-so. And come again." That was his full response. We've come a long way from the day when we submitted, when the people of America submitted their grievances to their congressmen and other elected officials, and they got an answer, a responsive answer. They may not have always gotten the remedy that they, or the redress that they were seeking, but they got an answer that was responsive. So in November of that year, 2002, we decided to try again. Following Congressman Hyde's hearing on the Iraq resolution, we put together the four formal petitions for redress of grievances. And we had the assistance of brilliant minds, constitutional law school professors in America. And we constructed a set of facts. And we embodied those facts in a series of questions that we wanted answered to, we wanted answers for. And we prepared those four petitions for redress of grievances, and we put them out for people to review and sign if they cared to. 8,900 people signed the first remonstrance or petition. Another 8,000, different from the first, signed the petitions for redress of grievances in November, October and November of 2002. And again, those four petitions, along with every signature, were served on every congressman and the president. And we respectfully requested that they send a representative over to the National Mall on November 14, 2002, to meet with people who would be coming there from all over the country, many in caravans, car caravans. And if they couldn't answer, their representatives couldn't at least answer the questions that we were asking, at least let us know when you will answer the questions. And again, everything we've done has been respectfully drawn. No harsh language. No outrageous demands. Everything professional, intelligent, and rational, nonviolent. We were there. We had a live webcast. Not one of our elected representatives sent a representative over to meet with us to let us know when these petitions might be answered. The four petitions for redress of grievances with all signatures, dealing with the government's violation of the taxing war powers, money, and privacy clauses of the Constitution. And those of you who have been following what we've been doing know that on May 5th of this year, or May, I guess it was May 10th, Once again, we have formally petitioned on these issues. A letter was sent. This is this second volume of our overall petition for redress deals exclusively with what we did, our request of May, and which has brought about this meeting. In May, on May 10th, we wrote to the President and to Senator Kerry. Both of them were in office and were served at the prior petitions, and they refused to or failed to even acknowledge their receipt. And we said to them in a letter and in an accompanying letter, which was addressed to the Treasury Secretary John Snow and to the Attorney General John Ashcroft and to the new IRS Commissioner Mark Everson, we said to all of them, we have new damning evidence that this direct, unapportioned tax on the labor, the slave tax, is unconstitutional. And we attached two research reports. One, this research report done by Phil Hart, who you'll hear from in a few minutes. And another, at the time, the researcher chose to remain anonymous, but a second research report, which he put on a CD, 400 megabyte research report. And we submitted those to the President and Senator Kerry and Treasury Secretary Snow and Attorney General Ashcroft and Mark Everson, the IRS Commissioner. And what we said was, in light of this evidence, on top of all of the other evidence, please come or send a representative to the National Press Club on July 19th and meet with us, people from around the country, and address these issues and answer these questions. And we also said in those letters that if this effort becomes as fruitless as our prior efforts, then we will immediately march down to the federal courthouse, where we will move the court to direct you to answer them, to answer the questions, and if you fail to punish you by allowing the people, recognizing, rather, our right to retain our money and to keep our money out of your hands. I should have asked earlier, I'll ask now. Is there anybody here from the administration in response to that request? No one here. There is an affidavit. Mark Lane has taken the complaint that you all have now seen and have a copy of. He's down at the federal courthouse filing the complaint. Along with the complaint is an affidavit by myself in which we detail for the court and present the evidence of everything we've done in our effort to get the government to answer some of these simple questions. And that affidavit is supported by all of these exhibits. So the court is getting a crate, along with the complaint, my affidavit, and all of these exhibits. The hard evidence of our petition for redress of grievances is before the court. When we form up from here and walk down to the court in support of the filing of this lawsuit, we'll stop. We'll go down Pennsylvania Avenue to 12th Street. We'll then go down Constitution, and we'll stop in front of the IRS headquarters building. And a copy of that crate and that complaint and that affidavit will be served in its entirety on the commissioner. We'll just stop there while we run in and turn it in and have somebody sign for it. And then we'll continue to the next block where the Department of Justice is located, and we'll do the same thing. We'll serve the Attorney General. I went to the White House. I was down here last week making sure everything was going to go smoothly here today. And I went to the White House, and they got the chief, president's chief counsel on the line. And he said, we needn't go by the White House today. The Attorney General will accept service for the president. So we'll stop there and serve. And then we'll go on down to the courthouse, where Mark Lane will brief us on how things went down there. But first, you know, some people say, you know, I've asked this right to petition it's a real hope of mine that we can bring this center stage in America, because I think it's the only hope for America. After all, there are only two. It is the forgotten right, but it holds out such great hope and promise. There are only two ways to hold government accountable. One is the ballot, and the other is the petition. But we know the ballot is only for the majority. After all, it takes one more than half the number of people voting for the issue to carry, whatever it is on the ballot. We all know, all our children know, that we, the people, are the source of all political power. Nobody gets into office unless we vote them in. The ballot is for the majority. But if our rights are individual rights, how do we as individuals and the minority, how do we get to hold the government accountable to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? It is the petition. There is no other way. No other nonviolent way to hold government accountable than the petition. And that was provided for us in the brilliance of the Founding Fathers. And we know where they got their advice from. So it's that important. We've framed this case. If you leave today with nothing else, understand this. We framed this case in such a way that for the court to deny us and fail to recognize the full power of this right to petition, if the court does that, they will in effect be saying, your relief is in the ballot box. If you don't like what's going on, you vote accordingly. When the court does that, the court will be saying what many people have suspected for some time, and to the delight of people like Alan Dershowitz, the court will be saying, this is a democracy, we're no longer a constitutional republic, we've completed the transition. Then there will be an upheaval in America. I would... You know, government, just one final word before... What time is it? I don't wear a watch.
11:40.
One final word before I bring Phil Hart up. Public education has all but taken over private education. There, you know, many of you may know that I'm in my 25th year of closely scrutinizing governmental behavior and comparing its behavior with the requirements of our state and federal constitutions, and then wherever I've seen an impropriety or a conflict, I've hauled somebody into court. I've done that many, many years in New York State. And, of course, over time, you obviously learn a lot. You come away with, you develop these observations. And one of the observations that I've developed with respect to this is public education has all but taken over private education. And the government has decided, it's probably a constructive conspiracy. I don't think they sat down and said, let's do this. But government has apparently decided that it is not in its best interest to teach the children that they have the ultimate power in America. That they have a developing responsibility as they go through their lives to know what their rights are, to pay attention to what's really going on in government, and then to confront governmental wrongdoing, unconstitutional behavior, whenever, wherever they find it, doing whatever's necessary to keep those officials from stepping outside the boundaries drawn around their power. After all, Jefferson said, when public officials take one step outside the boundaries that we've drawn around its power, they take possession of a boundless field of power, no longer capable of definition. Instead, our government schools are instilling this belief, as Charlie said, in the children that the state is sovereign. If you don't like what's going on, just vote, you know, this guy or that guy. You know, here we are today. Everything is, you know, Bush versus Kerry, and it's all political. Everything is framed in political terms. Nobody talks about, you know, the Constitution and right and wrong, you know, with respect to the Constitution. So public education, I think, is a big part of the problem. Another key observation that I've observed over the years, I'm sure I'm not telling you anything, but I just take things a day at a time. I mean, until I was 49 years old, I was like most people, having been led to believe that government is always benevolent and always has the public interest uppermost in its mind, and you could trust these guys and girls. But I've come to learn, obviously, when you take government officials to court and you charge them with something, you know, you get an answer. You get some kind of an answer. And you learn a lot when you do that over the years that I've done it. But one of those observations is that the judiciary is not the independent co-equal branch. It's highly politicized and very corrupt, unfortunately. I think in Florida we learned something about that, but nonetheless, it's true. And some law school professors that I've spoken to about this right to petition and these issues, and you say to them, you know, what does a free people do when they have some evidence that their government is operating outside the boundaries and will not justify its behavior? What does a free people do? And they say, well, you take them to court. That's what you do. Well, I want to tell you, some of you, I'm sure most of you don't know this, but with respect to the War Powers Clauses and the Money Clauses, in 1995, a group of us in New York and myself brought President Clinton and the Treasury Secretary Rubin to court for usurping the powers of Congress and Congress acquiescing. So we sued. It was the Mexican peso bailout. Clearly violated the money clauses and other clauses of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And what did the courts do? You know, here we are, bringing an action against the government, a constitutional tort. This is the Constitution. This is the meaning of the Constitution. You're violating it. And these rights are individual rights. One of my individual freedoms is freedom from a government that does this sort of thing. And what did the courts do? They dismissed the case for lack of standing. Now, what does that mean? This is serious. They do this all the time. If they don't want to hear a case, you know, today it's lack of standing. This is so offensive to me. A person doesn't have standing in court if what the court decides, up or down, in his favor or not, if that decision coming from the court is going to have no impact, it's going to have no meaning for the plaintiff. And the courts say, look, we're not in the business of giving opinions, you know. There has to be a case and a controversy here. Well, this action was brought by myself and others challenging the government's behavior under provisions of the Constitution. Of course we have standing. We're talking about the interpretation and the construction of the Constitution. I have to live under the Constitution forever. And other people are going to live under. Of course we have standing. The outcome of the decision, whether they rule in favor or against us, it's going to be, they're going to be interpreting the Constitution. Of course I have standing. Of course I'm affected. But that's not what the court ruled. Lack of standing. A couple of years later, in 1999, I and others, one other, a young man that had just graduated Fordham Law School, concentrating on constitutional law, was about to sit for his bar, pass the bar. He and his sister owned property in Montenegro and Belgrade. And his grandmother was sitting in an apartment over in Belgrade. And the bombs were falling on Kosovo. It was a decision to apply the armed forces of the United States in hostilities in that country. I and others, including him, and somebody from the 109th Air National Guard, and another recently retired Air Force pilot, now flying commercially, we and others took the president to court because nobody else was doing it. We checked. Nobody else was doing it. We took the president to court, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the Secretary of Defense. Burr Dietz served the papers in the White House and in the Pentagon. The judge said he wanted the papers served by 5 o'clock the next day. And Burr was put on a plane and went down and served the papers. What did that court rule? No standing. No standing. They had this way of saying, unless your harm is different in kind and degree from the rest of the community, you have no standing. What they're really saying is, this is democracy. It's really offensive. So we've been there. We've been to court, you know, challenging government behavior under the war, in violation of the War Powers Act, and violation of the money clauses. And you're about to hear from Phil Hart, who's been to court due to the government's violation of the taxing clauses. And you're about to find out what happened in his case. So obviously, the judiciary is politicized. Not right. Jefferson was right when he warned, and others were warned us about the judiciary. But it's wrong. It's dead wrong. So we have to do something else. And the appropriate next step when a free people has evidence that government is operating outside the bounds and will not justify its behavior, we're testing the attitude of the judiciary. We're going back in. We're testing their attitude. So what we're doing here. And, of course, we're retaining our money. That's the ultimate weapon that we have. And it's part of the petition process.